Welcome to everyone listening. My name is Henrik, and this is Red Eyes Radio. We go out worldwide 3 times per week. Bi-weekly, you'll be able to hear Radio 314 with Lana. Our website is redeyescreations.com. Regular radio programs on a wide variety of topics and frequently updated news also. This is investigations into important and interesting topics. We also report on the topics that we are curious to learn more about. Our inquiries should not necessarily be seen as an endorsement of the material that is presented, as it is more an attempt to find out more about all of the many claims that we encounter along our way towards the discovery of authenticity. And the website for all our fantastic supporters, members, and those dedicated to the full spectrum of what Red Eyes has to offer is redeyesmembers.com. Sign up for a membership and get full access to our archives. We have well over 700 programs on all kinds of topics, some nuggets of gold in there for you. We also have TV episodes, videos, films, commentary, and music there for you as well. Today we are talking with Alan Abadesa-Green, who together with Douglas Bowles and Bill Klaus is here to talk about the new Sync book, Volume 2. We begin nice and easy on the analysis surrounding Sync, the messages behind it, how it manifests in our world, and as our conversation goes forward, we go deeper into the dark, into more unknown territory, and the effects of how sync changes and affects the human experience. All right, welcome back, Alan. Hope you've been doing well. Good to have you back once again. Continue our conversation from, it's over a year ago at least, right, Alan?
Yeah, I believe somewhere about a year and a half ago, we put out the first volume of the Sync book in September of 2011, and I believe I spoke to you, I want to say October or November.
Yeah, it's got to be something like that. Well, it's good to have you back. I'm looking forward to talking, of course, about the new volume and everything else. But we have some guests with us here as well. We want to take into the conversation Douglas Bowles. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And also Bill Klaus. We haven't had either of you guys with us before, so it's nice to have some new fresh names with us here. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Alan, so, you know, as you said, last time you were with us, we talked about the first Sync book. You've edited and put together a second one now, Volume 2. I think it came out in November 2012. And there's, I think, all new names in the book, basically. A lot of guests we've had on Red Eyes Radio previously, like Paul Levy, John Cale, Anthony Peak, Lauren Coleman, Scott Onstott, and then we have had a few of these names on Radio 14 as well recently, Mike Cleland and Andres Jones most recently. Anyhow, tell us a little bit about the book, Alan. I wanted to know about, is there a specific reason for bringing in 26 essays or 26 authors?
Well, in the first book, that number was essentially random. The first book came together very innocently and loosely. I had been working in with the Synchronicity community, particularly the Jake Kotza crowd at the Sinkhole and some of the other synchromystic blogs. Not all of them consider themselves synchromystics, but there is a sort of community that had been established. And I just threw out an email one day and said, hey, what if we all put something together? If we all wrote about 10 pages, this could be interesting. And then as the chapters came in, very quickly I realized, wow, this is coming together to be a really amazing book. It really, really exceeded my expectations. And then the way people responded to the book, even more so. But as I was telling you last time, one of the biggest challenges I have with synchronicity is that it's so personal. Very often when we talk about synchronicity, it's a meaningful coincidence. Well, it's meaningful to whom? Usually to the person experiencing it. And then we can all look at the same context or the same synchronicity, but we might have different interpretations of what that means. So it was very important for me to get this just broad scope. And to answer your question about the 26 was that I think we got something like 22 responses back. And then at the last minute, got a few more added. And it was just down to the wire. We were about to put the book out, and then Steve Wilner signed on and a few other people signed on, and it was like, okay, great. So that number 26 was not intentional, was not no particular meaning behind it. Doing the second volume, I decided I wanted to do 26 again. I will admit I have a sort of secret plan at this point. I realized that tarot decks have 78 cards, which divided by 3 would be 26. So I have a plan of doing 3 volumes total. 26 different authors in each, and it sort of pleases me on some weird level to have a full tarot deck. But the real reason for getting 26 new authors before I even had that real plan was that, as I said, this idea of really trying to get a broad scope. And with the first book, I attempted to do that. 26 people, it's a pretty broad approach. But I wanted to reach outside of that community, some more into the conspiracy crowd, some more into the academic crowd, the more scientific crowd, just get different approaches. You did something recently on Red Ice. It was a commentary track talking about Red Ice's philosophy, and it pleased me to no end to hear that sort of have very similar philosophy that I've been approaching these sync books with. Mm-hmm. Is I might not necessarily agree with all the authors' perspectives or conclusions, but to me it's so important to get to hear all of those and at least consider them. And even the people that I don't necessarily agree with 100%, I definitely learned a lot from them or gained some extra perspective. So this has been the real idea, is to try and get as many voices, as many perspectives as possible, and learn as much as we can.
Definitely. Did you notice that one took a certain trail, shall we say, and the other one took another one? Is there a big difference between them, or do they kind of follow very much in the same manner? As I'm reading it, Alan, I feel that there's a lot of central themes, of course, that comes up again and again, and I'll ask you guys about that a little bit later, but what's your take on that, Alan?
Yeah, I feel like it's weird because the first book, right, has this black cover, and the second book has this white cover, but actually I feel like the first book's a little more light and the second book's a little darker. And that could just be, I did try and include some more of the, whether it be conspiratorial takes on some of the symbolism or some of the more Gnostic perspectives that, you know, yes, this world is all an interconnected thing, but is it a beautiful Gaian matrix, or is it the matrix? You know, is it some Gnostic black iron prison? So I definitely wanted to include people who took that approach and just give voice to as many different takes as I could. So in a weird sort of way, I feel like the second book's a little bit darker. It also came together during a slightly more rough period of my life. And of course, it came out just at the end of 2012, so you have all those fun little things in there of people, whether it be panicking or waiting for something great or laughing at the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, there's a good section on that in the book at the end of it. Tell us about that a little bit. A number of people have just kind of commented on 2012 and the whole end scenario, if you will.
Yeah, it was like when I realized the book's coming out end of 2012, I feel like, how do I not comment on this? But I wanted to take a lighthearted approach to it. And I just sent an email to all the authors from the first book as well as the second, and a few other people that I know in the community, or just some that, like, friends that I work with artistically and things like that. And just said, hey, would you just give me a few words? What are your thoughts on 2012? You know, this end of the world. And I said, you know, it could be funny, it could be serious, it could be anything you want. You know, just sort of wanted to mark this period in time so we can all look back on it, and whether that be have a good laugh or ponder something very serious or whatever it was, it just felt like to put this book out at the moment we did and not comment on it seems silly, but I didn't really want to devote a chapter to it or devote too much to it. So I said, hey, everyone just give me like a paragraph or so, where's your head at? And it's really fun to look at, absolutely.
I wanted to ask our other guests about there as well, if 2012 and this whole thing actually meant something to you guys. Now, in hindsight, of course, as we've come out through this, we're all still here. Is it a different world? Did anything change at all? Did we learn something? I guess, you know, most in this field would have a lot of thoughts on this. Douglas, how about you?
It's hard for me, coming from this, from the synchronicity standpoint, where we're looking at patterns, to not think of this in terms of a psychic weather that moves through everyone's consciousness. And just in my own personal life, seeing how much the pot has been stirred up since 12/21/12, I mean, it still goes on. It seems like this is a year of both high highs and really low lows, and I'm watching structures that are not supported anymore just crumble. You know, so you know, it seems like even though literally it wasn't the end of the world, there definitely was this unveiling of some kind that happened, and we're kind of, the curiosity to me is, so the mirror side of the coin, if 1221 is one side of the coin, 621 is the other, and so perhaps, you know, we've even turned another page now.
Yeah, I hope so. How about you, Bill? Any thoughts on this?
Well, that date has really strong personal significance to me because when I was in freshman year of college, at that age, around 18, kind of having my psychedelic awakening, and not being – the internet was around, but I wasn't very savvy with the internet. Finding Terence McKenna's books was, to say the least, a salvation. It was someone who had taken the psychedelic conversation out of the 60s and not just into the current moment, but had connected my mind with its past history, and that psychedelics were more a trigger and the thing in itself. And the way that McKenna spoke about the psychedelic experience, he gave it legitimacy in a way that made me feel important, that I was a part of something that wasn't fringe and that wasn't, well, you know, being raised Catholic, it assuaged some of the guilt that I had with my experimentation with chemicals, I guess. And at that point in my life, I needed something to hold on to, and focusing on a date that far off into the future, but promising such incredible rewards, it was the thing I needed at a certain rough patch to carry on. It was a sort of date and time that I said, I need to stick around to see that date. And if nothing happens, well, maybe everything will be better by then. So it was really sort of a life vest when I was floating in some pretty deep waters. And so for me, I kind of had this beautiful privilege of living, you know, those 18 years focusing and processing and digesting an end of time theory that was not apocalyptic, that was speaking towards transformation. And it wasn't religious, and it wasn't something from the past. This was someone who had come up with it in within my century, someone that I could hear his voice and read his words. So it was a very profound chance to kind of live in, for me, part in a historical process. And I'll always be thankful to Terence McKenna for that opportunity.
Indeed, yeah. Time Wave Zero and all that. This will be different for everyone, of course, but Bill, in your view, did it deliver what it promised, if it did promise anything?
You know, I think, and I don't offend anyone, but I really believe with Terence McKenna, you need to spend a lot of time with everything that is available to your ears and to your eyes. There are so many hours of lectures. He has approached the subject of time wave in so many different directions, so many different perspectives. It was never about the day 12/21/2012. It was about a man who was sort of abducted by an intelligence that offered him something that he brought back, something that he could share with people. It was sort of a picture of, you know, one of the objects that, you know, he says the self-transforming machine elves could hand to you. And it was something that he could pass around for everyone to marvel at. And I think it's what you do with the time wave itself. How much do you go into the I Ching? How much do you go into the mathematics? How do you relate it to your own personal experiences with the absurdly other and the things that you bring back? And I think he offered a picture of a man who, quite honestly, said went from the brink of schizophrenic madness into a very, very intelligent, well-grounded, and very, very funny human being. I don't think that you can say that Terence McKenna ended his life as a crackpot. I think he, in his final years, and for much of his later half of his life, was a very sane individual. Mm-hmm. And I think that what the time wave offers us is how a human being can receive a gnosis and an information like that, and how he can carry on and leave madness and return to sanity, but still have that evidence with him.
Hey, Douglas.
Go ahead. I was just going to say Bill's saying some pretty heavy stuff, but then on a lighter, sinky side, there's this film that came out on December 21st called This Is 40. And it seems like from a sink standpoint, you know, that was the humor of that moment for, you know, some of the colleagues of mine, because 40 is the age when you're allowed to study the Kabbalah. And so it's like, it's not an apocalypse. It's just a midlife crisis.
Yeah, but and yet you mentioned as well, and I think that's an interesting point you said before, Douglas, that structures are collapsing. It's evident that something maybe is different now. Whatever brings this on, we could, you know, talk about, of course. But any more clear examples of this that you're thinking about when you're talking about those things?
Oh, the kind of well, I mean, from a personal level, like the ego death. It seems like in my own research and studies, you realize. As a younger person, you know, the point is of life is survival, and your ego is like your spacesuit. And so at some point when you reach a certain age, your spacesuit stops to satisfy you. It's not meaningful anymore. So, you know, like if it's material existence that is the focus of life, you know, what happens when the pleasures of material start to fail, you need to connect to something larger. And I'm thinking in terms of like Dave Bowman, where he has to go beyond, you know, his spacesuit to find something to connect to that's larger than his little self. And so, I mean, so it seems like the structures I'm talking about are like egoic structures on a macro level, where like marriages that aren't built on anything sound are crumbling, or organizations that aren't, you know, it's just this kind of large scale growing up is my take on the Terence McKenna end of the world.
It's like things that are built on, you know, as you're alluding to, an unsound fundamental principle, let's say, maybe at the same time, things that are hidden if it's built on immoral things. This is a time when we're kind of, it seems on a mass scale, things are being more and more exposed, you know, with all the documents that are being released and leaked in terms of NSA spying. And I mean, there's so many multiple levels I think we can look at this. Would you agree with that, Douglas?
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the things that the people in the sync community do is just kind of look at these patterns that are happening and wondering, you know, one natural viewpoint that people take on the paradigm of conspiracy, that there's got to be someone manipulating all this, trying to achieve some kind of result. But then, you know, taken from a different point of view, you think, you know, this is just too big for any one organization to perpetrate or, you know, whatever. And so it just seems I end up with this notion of like psychic weather, that oftentimes the universe is pushing our own buttons, you know. And so we can either just play our roles and understand that sometimes the weather moves through and it's going to try and make us grouchy, or, you know, I guess if you get too identified with certain aspects of our humanity, you know, that's when the stress of like 2012 would come down on you and,
and crush you.
Exactly.
Well, it's an interesting take. If we're in a time where things are maybe more in that regard, maybe unhinged, or they're more, to me, it's always felt like we're standing more on our own in a way. We're what we create and manifest is even more apparent, I guess, in these days. Alan, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, again, from a personal level, it was sort of an end of the world for me. And it's funny because I am with the 2012 agnostic and all this. But basically, long story short, my wife is not from New York. I grew up in New York City and my wife moved there. She lived with me in New York for a few years and then kept saying, I'd really like to move. And I kept saying, well, from a political stance, I'm sick of America and American politics. I'm like, man, I wish it was a better country we could go to. And there's no place that really seemed appealing from that perspective. And where do we pick up and go to that we could start a life that would be more appealing? So this went on for a while, and I kept saying, well, listen, I got to finish this sync book. Can we talk about this afterwards? And our lease was going to be up at the middle of December 2012, and it just so happened in, I want to say, November, Ezra Sanzerbell, who's also in the sync book too, you guys might know him from Tone Color Alchemy. I believe he's been on Red Ice before.
Yeah.
He approached me saying, hey, you guys should move out to Portland. Me and Steve are going to be working on something together, which they are, by the way. Everyone should check out Steve and Ezra's Indiegogo. It's only going until July 2nd. Check that out. They did do that project. But of course, as you can tell, I didn't make it there. I didn't get out to Portland. But we kind of tried to make this happen all very last minute. We just told our landlord, okay, we're not renewing our lease. All right, we're going to move. And we packed up half our stuff, threw half our stuff out, and we were getting ready to move. And then everything fell apart. The whole thing fell apart. And here I was, December 21st, 2012, finding myself homeless. Hey, if I don't, you know, I don't have a place to move to in Portland. I just gave up my apartment in New York. Where the hell are we going?
Yeah.
And this was really, you know, looking back on it, it's kind of humorous that it all happened at this moment. But I went through my own personal little apocalypse at that moment where everything that I, all my foundations crumbled and I had to reinvent or rediscover new possibilities. From a larger geopolitical level, I would take this as very much, you know, I'm not, the Pope means very little to me on a personal level, but I don't really spend my days thinking about the Pope. Nonetheless, the idea that we have a few months into 2013, a Pope resigning, which hasn't happened for so darn long, it's essentially unheard of thing, is pretty impressive indication to me of something going on. From a sync perspective, I've been writing a lot about this idea that what's called a king kill, and this goes in with what Doug's saying about an ego death, this ego death or king kill, all these archetypes are connected and trying to show how they're connected to lightning bolts or the Kabbalistic lightning flash and all these different symbols that I'm saying are associated with this. So to see the Pope resign and then a lightning bolt strike the Vatican just to me rang true as such a confirmation of everything I was writing. Fascinating little turn of events.
Interesting. Yeah, it reminds me of Kingkill 33, right? Goes back even to the JFK assassination.
Absolutely, yeah. James Shelby Downard wrote Kingkill 33. I'm actually in the middle of a book right now I hope to have out by the end of this year, which is picking up on some of James Shelby Downard's work, but taking it into a more modern approach, emphasizing more of the synchronicities and less of what I consider some of his paranoia and some of the racism that's in that text that I think clouded his judgment, but showing how what he found with the JFK assassination is also true, is also present in the 9/11 event. It's also true in the quote-unquote killing of Osama bin Laden, although I don't really believe he was killed on May 1st. It is so, these events are so interconnected from a symbolic level that unless you want to argue from Downard's perspective that these are, as he calls them, evil Masonic sorcerers directing all these events. It's interesting to me because Downard actually says he calls them synchronicities and yet attributes them to evil Masonic sorcerers. And to me, I'm just too familiar with synchronicity at this point to attribute it to any group of human beings. It's not that I discount that you can manipulate synchronicity or manifest synchronicity. I am interested in concepts of magic, and there does seem to be some evidence that this is possible, but not on the scale that that I'm seeing or that I think he was even writing about.
Synchronicity and conspiracy can both not be true, Alan?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you take an event like 9/11 or the JFK assassination or whatever it might be, you obviously have a conspiracy going on. Someone shot that man in the head. Someone brought those towers down. And I'm you know, on certain days you might catch me, I'm much more interested in the conspiracy side of actual detective work of what does it mean, who did it, and things like that. But it, to me, you reach this gray area where you start saying, well, here are the symbols that are flying around, here are the synchronicities that seem, if I can use the term, strange, attracted to the event. And you start to say, where do we draw that line? At what point is it part of the conspiracy? At what point is it a sort of, as Doug might say, a psychic echo of the event, and all these different things? And I do not think they're mutually exclusive at all. I think obviously there's a human element in any synchronicity. There's something you're doing, and then there's this other phenomenon that's going on at the same time.
Bill, what's your thoughts about this?
I think that, you know, when you're going to go into synchronicity, you're inevitably going to come upon conspiracy theory. It's just inevitable. And you better have a pretty strong sense of self before you dabble with conspiracy theory, especially in the internet age, because it will consume you. I mean, I've spent an afternoon on YouTube watching 9/11 conspiracy videos, and 4 hours later, I'm convinced that no plane ever hit that building, a nuclear laser beam took down the structures, and that's just what the truth is. And then the next day, it's sort of a mirage. It can get tricky in there when you're mixing those two fields, I guess.
Mm. Your thoughts, Doc?
I should note, for your listeners who think that maybe this is a little too specialized as far as the terminology goes, I should note that both the Sync books do a really nice job of introducing people to this subject. Both the beginning piece in the first Sync book and the beginning piece in the second piece and the second Sync book just ease people into these topics as far as archetypes and pattern recognition and symbols and things. And so I just want to plug, you know, if you're a little lost right now, go to thesyncbook.com and there's something to help you.
Definitely. Yeah, I want to urge everyone, of course, to check out some of our previous shows, both that we did with Alan, but a lot of other guests that we mentioned before, and names will drop a little bit later here as well, as we've been involved in a lot of this. And you know, there's so many other central themes, of course, in this field as well. It's not just the dichotomy of synchronicity versus conspiracy, of course. It's much more than that. But there's, to me anyway, as I'm watching it, there seems to be a few central themes that do come up again and again. I kind of want to ask this as an open question. There seems to be a lot of things, for example, hinged on Stanley Kubrick's films, obviously, Pink Floyd, 42, you know, rainbows. There's like a number of these that are, they're just there in the field, if you will. And I want to ask that as an open question to either one was going to pick up on that. What you think is kind of directing some of these themes, the central themes that we see coming out of this field?
Bill, that's got to be you if it's a Kubrick question.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I think of Sync as a lens that allows you to pick out the particular jigsaw puzzles that you need amidst a swirling ocean of garbage that is either just noise or disinformation. And Sync allows you to grab the pieces you need to start putting together a picture of the universe that you self are living in and that you are a part of and that you are affected by and are affecting. And I think that concept is perfectly illustrated in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which is written, in the early part of the 20th century. And what Joyce is trying to do is to try to make people aware of the constructs of language that they are unknowingly or unconsciously in all the time. And I connected a straight line on the edges of this jigsaw puzzle I'm putting together, and the corner pieces are James Joyce, Marshall McLuhan, Stanley Kubrick, and the internet. And these four things are the corner pieces to seeing the true picture of what the 20th century is all about. Joyce started the conversation with Finnegan's Wake. McLuhan was a Joyce scholar, and he cut his teeth on Joyce before he became a nationally recognized albeit from Canada, media theorist who rose to such extreme visibility, but then fell away to where his books were out of print. I remember a Terence McKenna lecture where he was going to reference a McLuhan book. He simply couldn't bring the book to the conversation because it was out of print. And then I think Kubrick, who was explicit about his fascination with McLuhan and how it tied into 2001, A Space Odyssey, this line continues into Kubrick. And then I obviously believe that, you know, what 2001, A Space Odyssey is predicting is this all-inclusive, all-encompassing technology that all of us hold in our pockets, which is most brand recognized as an iPhone. It really is just internet connectivity in everyone's pocket. And what this is doing is it's shrinking the world into a manageable size. Communication lines are extended throughout the globe instantaneously. The unconscious is being evaporated and dissolved on a technological level as we speak. The problem is when you shine a light on there, you're not really sure of what you're going to find. I think The Shining is a perfect example of that. When you really start to find the tools to shine a light into your unconscious, there is a horror, I think, awaiting all of us. It doesn't have to be a specific type of horror, but everyone has to confront that place in themselves and in a macro level, that place in human history, and resolve just exactly what has happened, what we have done, and what we need to do to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes. So really what I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, Joyce was approaching this conversation from a literature standpoint. He was utilizing the novel as his ultimate expression, the way to leave something behind for everybody to utilize. McLuhan started to figure out that media were simply extensions of the human being. And Kubrick, realizing this and seeing that Joyce had already accomplished it within a novel, the next place for that to be accomplished was in film. And Kubrick was basically just translating this message into film. I could go into Pink Floyd at this point, but I don't want to ramble. I guess I'd let everyone else kind of comment as far as up to this point.
Yeah, and one was just, well, I was looking at the iPhone, of course, as you mentioned. It kind of is that, you know, the Blackstone ratio, 1:4:9 or whatever there actually was there. It's very much like that. So if this is about connectivity, we've never had this much, I think, at least as we know of in history, this level of interaction with other human beings and connectivity. And I guess we're all asking ourselves now and then the value of all the information that is being spread and shared, and obviously as well where it is going, you know, like the bigger picture of what the internet means and how it affects us. I think one of the things that comes up to me all the time is that we're faced with, for those who are watching a lot of news, let's say, or for those who are watching just one subject, this is so great about it. In one way, you can be really, really specialized and find anything about everything, basically. But it's also an approach where we have the world's problems as well at our disposal, in our hands. Right? All these aspects of what goes on in the world is now kind of launched into the mind of you know, us as individuals. And the question is, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? I don't know if we can break it up as simple as that. But any thoughts on this? Alan, let's begin with you.
Yeah, I think there was a few things Bill said in there that were really, really important. For one, this kind of touches a little bit back on that conspiracy idea he said earlier of how you can get lost in the conspiracy when he says that the shining of kind of facing your own horror. I consider that an iPhone, the internet, we have to start treating them, you know, not as a literal thing, but pretty darn close to a psychedelic experience, that you are opening yourself up to everything. This is a sort of unfiltered approach to, someone once described a psychedelic experience as load the universe into a cannon, aim it at your head and fire. You know, this is kind of what an iPhone does, is you can find just about anything. and you're going to find the horrors in the world, and you're going to find the beauty in the world. When you look at conspiracy, when you if you actually were to take a psychedelic and you were to look inside yourself, you're going to find those same things in there. So when Bill says you have to be careful approaching conspiracy, I think that's really important. But I would stress it's just as important when approaching any subject, because I see some people get lost on the love and light side. Some people get lost in the conspiracy side. And what I think synchronicity shows us is you're going to find these same things in everything, as above, so below, microcosm, in the macrocosm, et cetera, whatever phraseology you want to use. But you're going to find this everywhere, and it's essentially an expression of yourself and an inward search. When you're looking at the world around you, when you're looking at the internet, you're also looking inside yourself. These are so interconnected as to be mirrors of each other. And if you don't get really balanced really quick, it's very, very easy to get lost in one of these things, in one of these headspaces. That could be a dark headspace or a light headspace. So I think if there's one thing that we can stress very much is to know what you're getting into, know what an experience this is, and to, you know, if whether there you have some sort of meditative practice or whatever it might be, to kind of ground yourself before you do it. In an episode of Always Record that I did with Bill, which is a radio show we do for SyncBook Radio, we had this conversation about if you gave a 5-year-old child LSD, they would send you to jail. But this was around Christmas time. We did this show, and there were these stories about someone bought their kid an iPhone, and there was pictures of pornography already on the phone, and what a horror this was. And I'm thinking, but you just handed that kid an iPhone. Forget, I mean, the pornography, yes, that's bad. And at the same time, what else did you just hand them? You just handed them the keys to this unfiltered reality of everything that people are spewing. And how at 5 years old are you prepared for that? And if you're only, you know, this is a very American Western thing to get all your panties in a bunch over, oh, my kids saw someone naked. And again, it's not to trivialize that, but I guess my point is that that's the least of it.
Yeah.
You know, you've just handed that child a psychedelic. You know, we've just, every person lining up at the Apple store when they put out a new iPhone, they're lining up for a drug. And if they're not consuming it as such. This to me is somewhat, on one level frightening to me, and another level, the small part of me that kind of, sympathizes with the merry pranksters kind of thinks, hey, maybe this is how it happens.
Well, I mean, you're right. You're so right. What we're drawn to will be an individual quest. What is there for us to find? That's where we're going to be drawn to and be interested. At the same time, it is that abyss, if you will, that we can fall straight into, that we're looking into that abyss, basically. But the bigger question here is obviously, do we know what this is doing to us, both individually, but also as a, as the human race? And the bigger questions comes up here. Are we ready for this? Do we know how it is changing us? And I don't want to make this to sound from the point of view that, yeah, let's go with CISPA and SOPA and all this and censor the internet, government style, because, there's too much, dark and awful stuff on the web. Certainly not. But at the same time, on a psychological level, are we ready for this drug, as you're talking about, Alan?
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you made that disclaimer, because, that's not my I don't believe in censorship in any way. So that's a very, very good point. That's not what I'm trying to stress either. I guess it is just about I hate to make this sound like just a psychedelic conversation, but that to me is the best metaphor for what we're doing. When we talk about an iPhone, when we talk about exploring synchronicity, when we talk about exploring conspiracy or any of these alternative topics, we are taking on new perspectives. And I sometimes wonder, the reason I made the kind of joke about, maybe this is okay, this is how it happens, that people, there's no way to prepare people. When the first time I took LSD, I thought I knew, okay, I have a rough idea what I'm getting into here. No, I had no idea. And there's no way you could tell anyone what that was going to be like. And much the same way, the first few times you log onto the internet, you have no idea what you're getting into. Conspiracy research, synchronicity research, these are when Doug was mentioning the idea of old foundations falling away or ego deaths, this is what it is, because everything you know starts to have a question mark attached to it. Everything you've relied on disappears as you try out new perspectives, new perceptions. And this really is a shift in perception. And whether that means, whether we want to associate that with 2012 or not, we're doing that not just once every time the Mayan calendar turns around. We're doing that every day we log onto the internet, or every day we walk into the supermarket and have a weird synchronicity with someone walking down the aisle, or whatever it might be. But synchronicity research seems to show me is that we're encountering this every day, every moment, and it's a really good training ground. But it's also, in the last few years, I've become a lot more cautious as to how I tell people. And, you know, I'm not selling this as a brand new religion. I've never wanted to do that. I'm not trying to sell this as, hey, this is going to bring tons of joy into your life. There is that. But, yeah, you're going to have a dark night first. And, you know, when you step into that darkness, when you have to face your darkness, you know, there are the dark night of the soul might be a necessary step towards, I hate to use the word enlightenment, but some, you know, whatever you might associate that with.
Right.
And nonetheless, the dragon that you face in this dark night of the soul, it has sharp teeth and it can hurt you.
Yeah, I have a comment. I want to kind of extend this to into Steve Jobs and everything that's kind of happened there. But I want to let you other guys in here as well and comment on this. Douglas, how about you?
Sure. So, taking the conversation kind of more out of the spiritual context, we can just think in terms of the breakdown of an ordered universe that happened, sometime in the Middle Ages, or, you know, around the Enlightenment, where when the scientific materialistic paradigm really took over, and that became where the connection to spirit went underground. And so the only connection to anything spiritual ended up being like ghosts, demons, and the devil. And so it's interesting, as we're moving forward, you know, you can see this, how the vampires and the zombies and all the nasty creatures are coming, they're seeping out, because that's the relationship we can have to the spiritual is only through a dark spiritual. And we actually spoke on 42 Minutes to a woman who has a wonderful theory about this. Her name was Victoria Nelson, about how, like Twilight, you know, this is where we're having a dark transcendent moment, because, you know, we got out of balance. And so in terms of, you know, what the sync community is doing, it's just, and reconnecting to your larger themes of like Pink Floyd and Stanley Kubrick, it seems like for me, people are drawn to the story that they need to kind of process their reality. And therefore, a lot of the people in this community that we're part of, Pink Floyd speaks to them, all the 60s crap. And this is not me. It's funny because I do not sync my movies to Pink Floyd, but all the other dudes do.
And why is that, for those who don't know?
I think that it's just they're a different personality than me. So there's something that Pink Floyd speaks to, an essence of them that isn't necessarily me. But I definitely understand where that's coming from. So I do the same things, but with different media. I have my own whole shtick with 42. But just to bring it back to,
well, here's a good chance to defend Pink Floyd, if I might just jump in real quick. In that continuing line through Joyce and McLuhan and Kubrick, I would say that more so than the Beatles, more so than the Grateful Dead, though the Grateful Dead are their own universe, but they never achieved pop status. Pink Floyd took the studio and took music as a popular form of expression, and really were able to integrate the psychedelic experience into the details, right? They transformed music as we know it. I mean, it started with metal, and with side two, you can hear it with Echoes, which is a perfect sync up with the end part of 2001. But it isn't the question of whether or not the music was designed for that specific film. It's the fact that they were creating music that was on par with the artistic media that Stanley Kubrick was creating. And I think Kubrick is someone who created artistic, was a genius, and he was able to take his genius into an artistic expression, and that his films will be around for as long as people watch films. But the thing about Pink Floyd is that they were able to integrate classical music, tribal music, pop music. They were able to put all of those elements into the alchemical pot and then to create something that was on par. It took a trash media and made it art and made it high art. And the syncing of movies with Pink Floyd has less to do with the conspiracy behind the design. It has more to do with the artistic achievement, that the expression is there. And that they were, they completely were able to capture the time in which they lived in, the times with which we have lived, and the times which with which we are living in, and the fact that their music continues to become soundtracks for some of the greatest cinematic expressions, and then just your regular day-to-day emotional experiences. I think Pink Floyd is relevant in all those levels, but it speaks to the depth of their understanding and to the power of music and to the heights with which they were able to use that power.
Have to go on record on Red Ice talking about Rihanna. Thank you, Bill.
Beautiful.
Because so I became super obsessed with the American pop star Rihanna. Well, she's not American. She's Barbadian. But Rihanna. So here's this huge pop star, and she's doing the exact same things that Bill's saying of Pink Floyd. How somehow she, for me, is the soul of the world, that she completely embodies our moment, whether that's, you know, somewhat cheap, somewhat plastic, and somewhat machine-like, you know, because all the music today has this kind of robotic drum beat, and that's has more to do probably with Pro Tools than, you know, so our computers, we're becoming connected literally with our machines, you know. We like view the world through our iPhone. It's the lens now. And so, you know, you could talk about the merits of the music of Rihanna, but at the same time, what I found in this obsession, and it wasn't something I chose to do, you know, it was just my sync lens all of a sudden Strange Attack Rihanna, and for the past year or maybe 2 years, I've just been looking at all her work and everything she does and how it just seems so resonant with our current moment somehow, which is the exact same argument that Bill just proposed for Pink Floyd.
And that's it's not to say – it's funny because for me, the study of synchronicity has – in itself, multiple facets. I think it's really important. I don't know if Henrik, if you noticed this, but when I listen to Red Ice, it always kind of amazes me how many people on your show come on and they say, "Well, some weird synchronicity led me to discover this."
Yeah,
you know, it could be like the most random topic. You cover so many different topics, but I hear a lot of researchers say, "Well, this synchronicity led me to this," and
yeah.
To me, it's like this is why it's really important is let's discover what it is that's leading you to that. But you can take this. To me, synchronicity is important if you're a science guy like an Anthony Peake trying to study time. Well, this shows us how moments in time resonate or how archetypes emerge in time. If you want to be the spiritual guy like a Jake Kotze or a Paul Levy, well, then this is important because it shows you how you're interconnected to everything. But I think with Doug and Bill and myself, we're people who are attracted to this third prong of synchronicity, which is art. And it's how very often artists will either have a weird precognitive type thing. Like, you know, there's the classic example of that album Coup Party Music, where they're showing the Twin Towers exploding. And this was actually went to the printers on the morning of 9/11. You know, we can either say this is predictive programming, or as has happened to me over and over, where I have a really big issue with how often predictive programming gets used as the answer, is that this really does happen all the time. If you're an artist working, and then suddenly the thing you're writing about happens, and it raises all these interesting questions. But what I think Bill was trying to say about these artists, whether it be a Joyce or a Kubrick or a Pink Floyd, is that these were artists who started to understand the architecture of what they're working with. You know, just like a Philip K. Dick used the I Ching to write Man in the High Castle, or some filmmakers have used Kabbalah or Tarot as a framework for their movies. Now, to me, there's pros and cons to this, which I don't want to necessarily get trapped. We can go there if you want to, but there are pros and cons, just to say up front. I do enjoy when it's just pure inspiration coming in the moment. Nonetheless, I do think, is this Gurdjieff that says, right, you understand it, and then you kind of push it to the back of your mind. So if you're an artist, you figure out how synchronicity works, how these archetypes work, and then you kind of have to push it back, let the inspiration come. But what a Kubrick might do is build the architecture in which you can, and I've heard Bill say this a number of times, you can revisit this architecture and always find something new, always go back to it, and whether that's reinterpret it or whatever it might be, is because at some point these artists discovered how to build something, how to build a piece of artwork that not necessarily tried to dominate these archetypes. You know, to make a film based on Kabbalah or using the framework of the Kabbalah, that can go the wrong way. Is you can bog yourself down with the details, or you can understand, especially with synchronicity, you have to kind of leave room for mistakes, leave room for errors, leave room for synchronicity to actually come in and steer it a little bit. Mm. You can't be too domineering with it. And I think the best artists have kind of found, and I'm going to say again, this really fine balance of just enough control, just enough understanding, and just enough wiggle room to let the universe come in and sprinkle a little, you know, fairy dust or whatever in there, whatever it does.
And as the experiencer of all this, this is, in my view, in a way, is about self-observation, really. We have to be aware of what we are experiencing, or in some cases, actually just what we're being exposed to, be this media, movies, music, art. This is a kind of that's what makes this a little bit more of a spiritual practice, I guess, if we can put it in that category, that ultimately it's about us being aware of what is surrounding us and what is happening to us in our lives, because without that, this will just flow by us and we won't pick up on any of this.
About a year ago, I read it was called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And he was detailing the development of early science. And as they're dealing with forces that they don't comprehend, they can't measure it, they don't know what they're dealing with, but they're beginning to sense this. These different groups would form, and you would end up with schools of thought, and the schools of thought would compete, and then you would end up with a Hegelian-type dialectical situation where you'd have different groups that would oppose each other, and then a thesis would synthesize and that whole thing. But so what's fascinating to me is it seems like in this community, really similar things are happening, so that it just seems like from our standpoint – in modernity, we want to believe that we know everything, but it seems like what we as artists are saying is maybe we don't, and here's this stuff, and we're playing with it, but we don't understand it, but we're going to keep conducting experiments. I just don't know if science is caught up yet, or no, I know the science is not caught up to, you know, the kind of things, they're not even open to it. You had Rupert Sheldrake on your program recently, I think.
And, yeah.
You know, he's saying science is really closed off to certain things, and basically, we don't know what we're dealing with, but we like to play with it.
Well, you know, that's why I think that some of this, or the path that we are on, the human species, is things are going to happen to us nonetheless. I want to go back to the drug analogy that you made, Alan, again, because when the, well, in 2001, then Kubrick's, when the monkey goes from the human, if you will, this is an external source that comes in, but there's been speculations that this has been a drug, for example, in the past. This is what's unlocked the potential in our mind or spirit, whatever, however we want to look at that. And then we have this interesting connection. If we go back to the iPhone and the black stone and all that, Steve Jobs, of course, didn't invent the web, as we know, Al Gore did that. But with Apple, the forbidden fruit and the history that Steve Jobs has to LSD, he has certainly kind of put the web in our pockets. This constant connectivity, and this is something that I believe, then, as we kind of were talking about earlier, this is transforming our species, whether or not we want it. Maybe in the same way that we were transformed from, a monkey into a human, if we buy that, evolutionary step. But nonetheless, something happened in our past where we were in a state where we didn't know, didn't remember, if you will, into where we now are, like, writing history, and things have changed. Civilization is fairly newcomers on the scene. But the question is the medium of the internet, if this is something that has come to us as a transformative agent. Alan, thoughts on this?
Absolutely. You made reference to the stoned ape theory, right? The idea that at some point psychedelic mushrooms awakened something in these early primates that just sparked something in their minds. Going with that 2001 analogy, Jay Widener, I believe it was him who first said that, he noticed the monolith is the shape of the movie screen, right?
Yeah.
So here we have an association between, is it a drug or is it a piece of media? And what I'm kind of arguing is there's very little difference between media and psychedelic chemicals. One, you're actually ingesting a chemical substance, and one, you're ingesting this bombardment, this sensory bombardment of some sort of psychedelic dream, this projected dream. What we're doing with synchronicity is why a lot of synchromystic guys will play with pop culture, is because we can look at a piece of media and almost as like a shared dream or a shared synchronicity. We can all look at it, repeat it, play it over, and repeat certain aspects of that experience. But one of the reasons why, if we wanted to make this a truly scientific thing, media is not the most ideal thing. I don't know if there really is an ideal form of repeatable synchronicity, because it comes with the variable, just like LSD, just like Timothy Leary. If you read his psychedelic experience handbook, him and Ralph Metzner and Richard Alpert have this book, and they're the ones who laid out this idea of set and setting. Well, to me, this plays in with synchronicity, because just as you can't control someone's LSD experience, even if you're the CIA and you want to push LSD into the community, you can't control what experiences people are going to have on it. Now, maybe as we get our science gets better, this is where, and we can go down this road if you want, where, government-sponsored legalized marijuana kind of scares me, because I don't really want them manipulating those chemicals.
Yeah.
At the same time, but just to say, even if the CIA is pushing LSD, they can't control what environment you're in when you take it, what your personal chemistry is, what your background is, and how you're going to respond. Just the same way that if there was a piece of propaganda that gets put out there, the person who made that propaganda can't control what your environment is, what your personal synchronicities are with that media, and so on. So there is definitely this correlation between sharing a dream, sharing media, sharing psychedelic substances. And this is why I'm stressing there are pros and cons to it. I agree with you that you don't want to just – we should be aware of what we're consuming when we're consuming media. It's interesting to me, Terrence McKenna had this idea. If you read his Food of the Gods, he lays out these different drugs, and he lists television as a drug. He lists it under electronic drugs, and he says this is the most frightening of the synthetic drugs because it is a projected hallucination. There's nothing genuine about it. The person gets to give you whatever hallucination they want to give you. Well, what synchronicity shows me is that Terrence McKenna, that's an incomplete or incorrect or not completely correct, I should say, statement, because synchronicity comes in and the media is not a controlled substance either. It is not something that can be completely directed. Nonetheless, I definitely can see that it's much more directed than a lot of other psychedelic experiences.
Before we talk more about the book and give out the websites here towards the end of the first, I want to let you guys in here if you want to comment on this. Douglas, how about you?
Well, so Alan continually returns to the psychedelic thing, and I want to stress, so I'm not a psychedelic person. I'm pretty square. But I think that psychedelics as a tool, as far as if there's a goal in this, it's and what our media is communicating is connectedness. But as an individual, you feel like you're separate, that there's no connection. And I think psychedelics definitely do this job of breaking you down and opening you up and saying, look, you're not separate. You're completely connected. But what's fascinating to me is that our technology is now catching up with the 60s. So it's also communicating the same paradigm of non-separateness, which is the whole thing with an ego death, and we come back to the, you know, the king killed. So that, you know, maybe that's what we're going through as a species now, is this realization that we're a lot more connected than, you know, than what we believed for quite some time.
And is that a good thing overall?
I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't know if we have, you know, it. Hopefully it's a good thing, because
I guess we'll see what happens.
There's an awful lot of suffering. Yeah, there's an awful lot of suffering, and hopefully, if we maybe we'll have more empathy if we realize that, you know, we're the same thing. That there isn't any, you know, me and you. The space between is less than we realize.
Bill, any thoughts on this?
I guess just real quick, Terrence McKenna used to repeat a quote from Jacques Ellul that said, there are no political solutions, there are only technological solutions. Everything else is just propaganda. And he meant everything besides technological solutions is propaganda. And I tend to believe that. I think that what Steve Jobs and Apple and whatever the brilliant minds, to be able to produce this product, to masquerade it as a product, and to put it the technology into how many millions of people's hands, from the richest to seemingly poorest, it seems like everyone is united through the availability of these smartphones. And what it does is it gives voice and connectivity from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the mountain, and it's put up or shut up time. All the information is streaming into these little rectangular squares. They kind of remind me of the boxes from Ghostbusters that trap the ghosts, except these boxes don't speak to imprison the spirit. These boxes seem to want to connect and transform the spirit. And I just have nothing but hope in the human being and the human spirit and the human heart to just flow through this absolutely miraculous piece of machinery. And really, we call it machinery because it's too scary to really recognize it simply just an extension of ourselves. And I think that's where a psychedelic experience comes in and is able to sort of elicit the poetry of it all and to make it a little fuzzier than the square edges lead you to believe. So,
all right, very good. We'll pick this up in a little bit, gentlemen. Let's talk a little bit about some of the websites. And Alan, first of all, I know that you wanted to run through the authors of the book as we did last time as well, and give a shout out to everyone who's in the book. So please go ahead, Alan.
Absolutely. I'll try and do this as quickly as possible. There are 26 new authors in the Sync Book Volume 2. The book is available on Amazon, or I suggest you go to thesyncbook.com, and you will find both volumes and a bunch of other great stuff. In the second volume, the Sync Book, we have Joe Alexander, a fantastic filmmaker who I feel like it has inherited and taken Jake Kotz's old Sync videos to a whole new level. I really hope everyone checks him out. Richard Arrowsmith, my brother from Sirius, Mike Cleland, who I know was on Lana's program, Radio 314. I love Mike. Lauren Coleman, I know, has been on Red Ice. We have Anaday, Frater X. He's putting out a new book from Sync Book Press he's working on that is about the secret war inside Freemasonry. Freeman, who's been on Red Ice many times, is in this book. Mark Golding, who provided the wonderfully gorgeous mandalas that are all over this book. Jason Horsley, also known as Alias Cephas. Victoria Hunt, John Kale, a good friend of Red Ice. Bill Klaus, my good friend that's here today. Mark LeClaire, the Wrong Way Wizard. Paul Levy, another Red Ice alum. Trish and Rob McGregor, they just put out a book that people might recognize. It's called Aliens in the Backyard. I believe they've been on Coast to Coast and a bunch of shows talking about their book is about UFOs and synchronicity. Nexus of Sync, a German sync blogger. Scott Onstott, Secrets in Plain Sight. God, I love that guy. Anthony Peake, another favorite of mine. Robert Perry, who comes more from the academic side. David Plate, a co-host of mine and Bill's on the radio program Always Record. He's a fantastic filmmaker. I want to talk, maybe we can talk a little bit more about Always Record in the second hour, but I hope everyone checks out David's videos. Riot Fish, they're actually two guys, a writer and an artist, did a comic for this one. They are doing the most cutting edge. I've been in the comic industry a while, and they're doing the most cutting edge comic stuff you will find out there. I hope everyone checks out Riot Fish. Alex Robinson, a New Zealand conspiracy slash synchronicity slash everything, wonderful woman from New Zealand. Ezra Sanzerbell, Tone Color Alchemy, make sure to check out his Indiegogo. Noah Sherrill, a great filmmaker. Dr. Kirby Surprise, who is an academic who's trying to toe that line between playing with some quantum reality and some spirituality. He's awesome. And Frank Zero, who comes at this from the a mix between conspiracy and cartoons. So I hope everyone checks out Sync Book Volume 2. Great authors in there.
All right. Very good. TheSyncBook.com is the main website. And Douglas, give us a quick outline of 42 Minutes here.
Oh, 42 Minutes is a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our moment. It kind of grew out of a need to promote the first volume of the Sync Book. We started in October of 2011, and primarily some of our early shows were just talking to the different authors from the Sync Book about their pieces, but it's really grown into something special recently. We keep getting fabulous guests. We talk for 42 minutes naturally, and hopefully we get to the answer to life, the universe, and everything. That's always the goal. I co-host it with my colleague and friend William Morgan, who's also a great sync filmmaker, and you can find some of his films at thesyncbook.com. We have a video tab, and all the videos from the community are starting to make their way there. You can find the program at 42minutes.com. We also have a tab at thesyncbook.com. It's a lot of fun, and so I wholeheartedly recommend your guests to come check it out. It's primarily it's just the space for our guests to you know, we want to explore their theories, and so that's what we do. It's the way that we kind of stay in touch with, you know, what's going on. It's the flows of the universe are reflected kind of in the guests that we get week after week. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, very good. Absolutely. And Bill, tell us a little bit about Always Record here before we take a short break here.
Always Record. I approached Alan. He was doing a lot of interviews on the internet, and I enjoyed what he had to say, but it seemed like he was being asked the same questions over and over. And I kind of commented to him that, you know, whenever I'd be on the phone with him, our conversations seemed to really be alive and really be interesting. And me thinking, God, I wish I would have recorded that. I would love to revisit some of the things that he said. And out of a conversation like that, we contacted David Plate, who is just a genius and can speak so thoroughly and in-depthly on so many subjects. And we just started to meet once a week, push record, and just take as far as we can. Some days would go 4 hours. I think one day was 6 hours. Some days an hour and a half. But it's just an ongoing conversation that incorporates a lot of themes, ideas, things that happen in the news, things that happen in our personal lives. And we hope it's as entertaining and insightful to the listener as it is to the people involved. So check it out.
All right, very good. Links are to be found from thesyncbook.com. Check out volume 2 of the book as well, as we've been talking about. All right, gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be back with more in the second. Thank you for this first one. Proceed with the second hour at redicemembers.com, our members' website. You can go there to sign up and get access to our archives. We spare you from commercial interruptions and website ads. When you want to get full access and listen to our continuation of this or any of our previous programs, sign up and at the same time support our endeavor as we expand into new areas and productions. In the second hour, we will go much deeper into this topic and talk about the dark side of sync and how it affects people both in negative and positive ways. This is all experiences that broaden our range of understanding, learning, and perception. And towards the end, we come out of the other end of the wormhole, if you will, that we entered into in the beginning. Don't miss this continuation, a fascinating discussion with Alan, Douglas, and Bill. Okay, but before we proceed, coming up on Red Ice Radio, we have Stefan Kinsella, Stephen Mailer, Jeffrey James, and Tom Secker. Follow us at redicecreations.com and sign up at redicemembers.com. Thank you for staying with us and listening. We'll be right back with more.